So on Sunday mornings through the summer holidays, we're doing the first six psalms. We've seen two ways to live in Psalm 1, and we've chosen the way of life so that we can be like the blessed man. In Psalm 2, we've kissed the Son, lest he be angry. We've taken refuge in him so that we might be blessed. And then what happens? We're pitched straight into trial and difficulty in Psalms 3 and 4. They show for us that the blessed life is not an easy option. The walk of the believer is a testing walk. We're faced with the despair and difficulty of the psalmist. In Psalm 3, we saw that the context was that of David fleeing from Jerusalem when Absalom had raised up or won the heart of the nations and had claimed the throne for himself. There were specific opponents and foes. Here in Psalm 4, we don't know the context, and we don't know what the trouble is that he's facing. But in verse 1, where he says, give me relief from my distress, and in verse 2 as well, the words there are talking about being in a tight place, being in a difficult place, being constrained and hemmed in and feeling there's no way out, being in great difficulty. And as David finds himself in this situation, he describes how we might respond. There are four different ways that we might respond in this psalm. There are three wrong ways to respond to distress and one right way. So this morning we're going to be looking at seeking answers in distress. And as we go through, notice the gentle way in which David deals with those who perhaps aren't responding in the right way to distress. So the first wrong way to respond when you're in a tight situation is this: don't get deluded. Don't get deluded. Verses 2 and 3. It's almost as though after David calls, a heavenly voice says in verse 2, how long, O men, will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? Psalmist is telling us this, that when we're in tight places, when things get difficult, there's a very big danger of being deluded that our God does not care for us and to start seeking relief somewhere else. And as we do that, we bring dishonor to God. Because we're saying, I don't believe God can look after me. There's an answer somewhere else. And we turn God's glory into shame. The glorious God who's promised in Psalm 1 that he knows the way of the righteous. In Psalm 2 is talked about taking refuge in the Son. If we then live as though he doesn't care, we're saying Psalms 1 and 2 are nonsense. We're turning the glory of God into shame. If we go chasing after other solutions when we're in distress, we dishonor God. How is it that we dishonor God? Why is it that that's the case? Because there in the second half of verse 2, we love delusions and seek false gods. You see, even as a Christian, when tight times come, it's very easy to put our hope elsewhere. It's very easy for our understanding of the world around us to get so skewed that we're deluded and start seeking help elsewhere. And we dishonor God. As the screw tightens, we can pour more of our efforts into vain hopes rather than to trusting God. Perhaps it's the person with an illness or an injury, and they've prayed for help and God's grace, and it's not being healed. And then what takes over is that healing, that wholeness and restoration is the big thing. And they chase after that. And it's from one doctor to another. It's from one medicine to another. It's from one website promising hope to another. And money is spent, and all the preoccupation is, I want to get better, I want to get better. And there's no sense of, well, what's God saying in this? And what do I need to learn from him? And the cure becomes the be-all and end-all. It becomes, in a sense, the idol that we're chasing. And the faithfulness of God through trials is disregarded. In effect, we're saying, God's not worth relying on. I'm going to press on for what I want in this situation. Perhaps it's the young person facing exams. Some of you have been there and you're waiting for the results this Thursday. or the situation in work, and you're focused on that next goal. You know that if you study these exams, you can go on to take some more exams. And then you go on to take some more exams. Sounds funny, actually, when you put it like that, doesn't it? But when you're in a situation, it seems so important, doesn't it? When you're at work, getting that next promotion, and the danger is that those things, that tight place where you're having to study and you're under pressure, that goal becomes the God. And we go chasing after that. If I just have that, I'll be fulfilled. And then you get that, and then I must have that, and I'll get fulfilled. And in that tight place, what happens to your relationship with God? Well, I'm studying, so I haven't got time to read the Bible and pray. I'm under pressure. There isn't time to be at church. I need to be back home and revising, and God gets squeezed out. And you start chasing after false gods. It's so easy to end up disregarding the Lord's opinion of you and his word as you get caught up in the exams and the promotion. Or perhaps it's the person who's worked hard for the Lord for many years. You've been a faithful church member. You've thrown your everything into the life of the church. And now you're in a tight spot. Things are difficult. And you just sense, Lord, it's not fair. What are you doing? I don't deserve this. I've been one of the ones who's worked so hard. Why is it not easier? Lord, you owe me something for all of my service. And you get hung up on this delusion that because you're an honourable servant of the Lord, you deserve better treatment than this, that life should be easier, that time should be more pleasant. And the danger is you get disgruntled and bitter and angry because you've been deluded. And you bring disgrace to the God that you've been following faithfully so far. And then we get this sealer at the end of verse 2, this pause, stop, think on this. Does this describe you this morning in your tight place? Are you chasing after some delusion? Have you been fixed on some false god and you've forgotten your God? And you'll bring in dishonour and shame to him. Are you prepared to continue like that? Or are you ready to change? You see, the psalmist says there are two things we need to know so that we don't turn God's glory into shame. And they're there in verse 3. Firstly this, know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. Know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. If you're struggling with that illness or that injury, if you're facing those exams and that pressure to get promotion, if you're disillusioned because you've served so faithfully and things are so difficult, or whatever the tight place, don't forget this, that God's chosen you to be his. That you're set apart, that his eye is upon you. And he's chosen you for salvation, he's chosen you for glory. He's at work in you to take you home to be with him forever. He's marked you out as belonging to him. He's brought you into his covenant by his grace. Jesus has died for you. The Spirit dwells in you. He wants us to live for him and not for ourselves. We've been set apart from sin to serve him. In fact, in Ephesians, we're told we sit with Christ in the heavenly places. And one day Jesus is coming to take us to be with him forever. The Lord's set apart the godly for himself. Don't forget that when you're in a tight place. And secondly, know that the Lord hears the cry of the godly. Because God has chosen you to be his child, he will answer when you call him. Because we are his special people, he does hear when we cry out. It's like the mother's ear, and I use the mother carefully because at night time when our children cry, I sleep through everything. But Jane is just, I don't know, tuned in. So even if she's asleep, if one of the children stirs or rolls over or sneezes, Jane is awake. She knows their every need. And other mothers will know just what that is, to be tuned in. And God is, in this sense, like a mother to us. His ear is tuned to the distress of his children. God hears us when we cry. He hears our calls in distress. And he works the situation out in a way that's best for us and for his glory. Not necessarily how we'd like him to deal with the situation. So it may be that we're not fully healed. It may be that we don't pass our exams. It may be that the situation we're facing as a mature believer doesn't get any easier. But the knowledge that God is our Father, and that He knows our situation, and that in His good time He will work things out, can bring us peace and joy even in the distress. Does it seem to you that He's not hearing your cry this morning? Well, can I urge you to keep calling and know that He hears? Don't get deluded. The second wrong response in times of trouble is the danger of letting anger rule. Verses 4 and 5. In your anger, do not sin. When you are on your bed, search your hearts and be silent. It's very easy when things are difficult, when situations are unjust, to be righteously angry. That's fine. But the danger is that that anger spills over into vengeance and wrath that leads us into sin. We find that in David's followers throughout David's life, there are times when David is oppressed, when he's opposed, and yet he desires to be merciful to those who are against him. He's angry with the way they're behaving, like his son Absalom, but he desires mercy. But his opponent, his followers, they have that righteous anger, but they don't have it under control. And so as soon as one of David's enemies crops up, in goes the sword, off comes the head, whatever, their anger leads them into actions that are inappropriate and wrong. It's the hot-headed response to distress. When difficult times come, the heart begins to get angry, the fists clench, and boy, I'm going to deal with this, and are they going to get it? So when my health is not as I want it to be, it's the doctor's fault. It's my parents' fault. It's the hospital's fault. And there's anger, and it's all the frustration is taken out on them. When the exams aren't going well, when the promotion doesn't come, it's everybody else's fault. And boy, they're going to get it. And I'll have my papers remarked, and I'll sue the school and whoever else. And, oh, anger. Or in the church, when you're finding things difficult, and it's the pastor's fault. Or the deacon's fault. Or it's the fault of the old people in the church. Or it's the fault of the children in church. Whoever it is, it's someone else's fault. And you're angry. And your anger leads to bitterness and sin. And again, we've got to seal it. Stop. Stop. Is this how you're reacting in your tight place at the moment? Is this the state of your heart? Is your mind, as you go to bed at night, filled with indignation and anger? That's a wrong response. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? Well, David's got the answer there in verse 4. In your anger, do not sin. When you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. David says, when you're in a tight place and you're getting angry, instead of looking at everybody else, stop and search your heart. Look in. Now that's incredibly difficult, because it's easier to point the finger everywhere else. But David said, stop, search your hearts and be silent. Reflect on your responses in this situation. Is there anything I need to resolve here? Is there anything that I need to confess and seek forgiveness for? Are there any wrongs that I need to put right? Calm down, says David. Think through your motives, your response. Have another look at the facts of the case. See, there's often far more going on than we know about, and we need to be very careful not to hear a piece of news and fly off the handle in response, no matter how righteous we feel our anger might be. How many angry situations would be diffused if before people went to bed at night they stopped and searched their hearts and were silent before the Lord? Back just after the Second World War finished, the Brethren Church in Germany went through a huge crisis. When Hitler had come to power, he'd made churches register with the state, and the Brethren Church had been split. There were those who felt it was safer to register and to be publicly recognised because it was easier. And there were others who thought that was wrong. To be linked with Hitler's government And so they went underground. They would not register. And many of them were arrested and put in prison. And some of them died in the concentration camps. And after the Second World War, when Hitler is dead and peace is being restored, there was tension, anger between the two sides, particularly on those who didn't register. You compromised. My dad died because of the stand he took. How dare you think you can come back into our church and have influence? And there was real problems. So the elders from both groups came together. And for the first couple of days, in the place where they were meeting, they went off on their own, sat with God's word, and reflected and prayed. And when they came back together, they didn't have any problems to resolve. And the church was reunited. That's amazing, isn't it? They didn't need to talk through the issues because they'd looked inwards. David says, "Search your hearts and be silent." And then he goes on to say, "Offer right sacrifices and trust in the Lord." The reason that we can look at ourselves first and not try to resolve the situation is that we have a God who will do what's right, and we can trust in him and his timing, because he actually knows all the facts. And he knows everything that's going on, and he will bring everyone to judgment in the end, and everyone will get what they deserve. We don't need to take justice into our own hands, because we have a God who is fair and just, and in good time will do all things right. Constantly in the scriptures we're told, "It is mine to avenge, says the Lord." Don't take that into your own hands, because often it leads to sin. We're to trust, therefore, in our God, to rely on him that he will do what is right, waiting on his timing rather than taking things into our own hands. We need to leave the all-seeing, the all-wise, the all-powerful God to do what's right, rather than to think that I, with my limited understanding and my sinful nature, will actually get the right answers. And that means, doesn't it, that there are things that we need to repent of today. That we need to come and leave with God and say, "Lord, I've been trying to solve this. I've been trying to take this into my own hands, and I can't do it. And I'm sorry for the mess I've caused. I don't understand the situation. I'm angry, but I want to leave it with you and to trust in you." We have a God that we can trust. There is a way of repentance for ourselves. He talks about offering right sacrifices there. Well, we know that Jesus has died, bearing our sin, taking it away, that we might be forgiven. So when you're in a tight corner, don't get deluded, and don't let anger rule. And thirdly, don't despair. Verses 6 and 7. The other temptation, when times are tight and we're under pressure, is to cry out, as in verse 6, "Who can show us any good?" Where's the hope going to come from? How is this going to change? God's not answering my prayers. People around me are failing. Everything's difficult. Where's anything good going to come from? What's happened to the promises of God? What's happened to the people of God? And this is the temptation, isn't it? We see it with David's followers. In fact, we see it all the way through the history of Israel. Aren't they grumbling and murmuring constantly? And the lessons in the Old Testament are particularly pertinent to us, because in the wilderness, God provides one answer to prayer, and within days, they're moaning about something else. And then God answers that one, and within days, they're moaning about something else. Isn't that the way we can be, despite God's goodness? That we can say, "Who's going to show us any good?" How many of us, if we're honest, are feeling that at the moment? We're despairing. We're actually thinking, "Well, where's the change going to come from? How's that going to be impacted? Where's the relief going to come from?" We're despairing. Maybe it's the salvation of a loved one, or our health, or our employment, or our family situation. I don't know what it might be. Church life, maybe. But we're despairing. Where's the change going to come from? And verse 6 says, "Many are asking it." It's often the case. The majority of people are grumbling, are murmuring, are despairing. Who can show us any good? And it's the danger that this mood can characterize our church lives. We're singing praise to God, and we're thinking this is all a waste of time. We're trying to tell other people about Jesus, and we're thinking no one's going to be saved. And we're just despairing. We're too wise to be deluded by the lies, like the first category of people. We know that those things won't help us. But we're too miserable to be encouraged by the truth. It's not like the old days, is the danger. And in fact, it's possible that the people in verse 6a who are saying, who can show us any good, are also praying at 6b, let the light of your face shine upon us, O Lord. They're pleading, God, show us your favour, and at the same time they're asking, who can show us any good? There's this sense in which we're praying and it's not working, so where are we going to go? What's going on? Surely if God was shining his face on us, the situation would be different. What two things do we need to do when we're tempted to believe that no one can do us any good? David says, pray and reflect. Pray and reflect. If it is David who's praying in verse 6b, he's calling out that the light of your face shine upon us, Lord. And then in 6b, he's wanting to know the presence of God, not material blessings. That's the important thing. David wants God's peace, not necessarily an answer to the problems. And then he reflects on his own experience in verse 7. He says, you have filled my heart with greater joy than when their grain and new wine abound. David says, think of the people who are having a party. They've just had a bumper harvest. Everything is going fab for them. All human experiences are wonderful. And they are bouncing around. And David says, God's given me greater joy than they've ever known, even without the party. David says that when God's face shines upon me, the situation may not change, but I know greater joy than can possibly be known, even by those who have everything. And David, as he goes through many of his experiences in life, as he has nothing, as he hides in the cave with the criminals from Saul on the run, as he exits Jerusalem, as his son rebels against him, as he goes through these times, can look back and see the joy he's given him even in those situations, and knows that now, no matter what the context, God can fill his heart with joy again. David can look back on God's faithfulness and rejoice even in tight times. How often do we look back and reflect on God's goodness? How often do we share it with others? How often are we able to say, well, it doesn't look good at the moment, but my heart's full of joy because I've got a great God and I've got so much to be thankful for. In the Message translation of this psalm, it says this: why is everyone hungry for more? More, more, they say, more, more. I have God's more than enough. More joy in one ordinary day than they get in all their shopping sprees. That's it, isn't it? That's it. That's what David is able to say. Don't despair. You can know God's joy, greater joy than the world ever knows, even in distress. So those are our three wrong responses. Don't be deluded. Don't let anger rule. Don't despair. Let's see finally this morning David's right response in times of distress. Because David says, I lie down and sleep in peace, verse 8. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. How is it that we can lie down and sleep in peace? Well, David does six things in this psalm that help us and give us a good example of how to respond in distress. And the first thing is, he prays. Right at the start, answer me when I call you, O my righteous God. Even though David doesn't seem to have been getting answers, even though there's a sense of distress and despair in his voice. Answer me when I call you. There is a sense that he's been in this situation for some time, but he's still praying. Even though maybe he feels that his prayers aren't going beyond the ceiling, even though he feels as though his prayers aren't being answered, he knows his hope still lies in prayer. And he sticks at it, doesn't he? Answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Be merciful to me and hear my prayer. He prays. Notice too that he remembers who God is. He calls him the righteous God. Oh my righteous God. He remembers that his God is a God who does things rightly. there is no shadow of evil in the Lord, that there is no duplicity, there is no unkindness. Here is a God who acts righteously. And although the face may seem to be frowning at the moment, David trusts in the righteousness of his God. Have you ever been in a situation where you've needed help and you're looking around and you're trying to suss out who can help you? And you see someone with a really friendly face and you think, aha, I'll go to them. And they turn out not to be the person to help. They're quite grumpy, actually. They look on the exterior as though they're friendly, but the heart's not there. And then you see someone else who looks really grumpy and miserable sitting in the corner. You think, I'll never touch those. And they're the one who leaps up and helps you. You see, the face doesn't always tell the story, does it? It's the reality of the heart. And sometimes it feels as though God's face may be frowning on us, but David knows that his God is a righteous God, that behind whatever the countenance seems to be, because of the circumstances, that his God will do what is right. And David is not going to forget that. We need to remember who our God is as we pray. And thirdly, he remembers what God has done. We've already mentioned this. In verse 1, give me relief from my distress, could be translated, you have given me relief from my distress. But certainly in verse 7, he says, you have filled my heart with joy. As he's praying, as he's calling out, as he's remembering who God is, he's looking back and remembering what God has done. He's remembering God's faithfulness. He's remembering that God has looked after him. And that encourages him to keep praying because he knows that he is the Lord's. He also recognizes who he is as he's praying. He's not waltzing into God's presence and saying, look here, God, what do you think you're playing at? I'm the king. I'm the anointed one. It shouldn't be like this. How dare you? No, in verse 1 he says, be merciful to me and hear my prayer. David says that even though I'm a believer, even though I've received your mercy in bringing me into the kingdom, I still need your mercy every day. I don't deserve anything. I'm reliant on your kindness every day. And even as Christians, we need to remember this, that it's mercy daily that we need. We have no rights when we stand before God. We cannot make our demands as though we are deserving, even though we are his children. We receive mercy day by day. Great is your faithfulness, we sang earlier, morning by morning, new mercies I see. He prays. He recognizes who God is. He recognizes what God has done. He recognizes who he is. And then he thinks through the various wrong responses, doesn't he? In verses 2 to 7. He reflects on how his heart could turn. He looks at the ways that he could be drawn into as he finds himself in a distressful situation, in a tight place. And he argues with himself. No, don't go that way. No, don't go that way. No, whatever you do, don't go that way. Make sure you rein yourself in, says David. And notice that the bulk of the psalm is this. It is this wrestling with himself. And there will be much of our prayer lives that is actually wrestling with ourselves. Catching our thoughts and reining them in. And that's hard, isn't it? I had a quiet time this week. I'm going through Luke's Gospel. And was challenged in that portion where it talks about not being anxious because the Lord clothes the lilies. The Lord provides everything you need. And I'm thinking, what might I be anxious about? And then I'm thinking about the fact we can't sell our house and it would be nice to buy here rather than rent. And for the rest of my quiet time then, what's dominating my thinking? Can't sell the house, need a house to... And I've got to wrestle then, haven't I? That's it. As God challenges, I've now got to work this through. I've got to argue with myself. I've not got to let myself be drawn down wrong ways of thinking. I've got to think through the wrong responses. And then finally, David trusts. He trusts. He gains confidence as he's looked up and realized what God has done and looks at the false ways he could go, and then he rests and says, I know what I've got to do. God's in control. I can sleep. I can lie down and know peace. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. His lying down and his sleep come together because he's trusting in the Lord. He realizes that it's God alone. God doesn't need his help to sort the problem. God doesn't need anyone else's help to sort the problem. David can trust in God alone to deal with the situation. There's a sense in which, yet again, as we saw last week, there's a heroic, childlike confidence in David here. No matter what the situation, no matter what the distress, is he in the back of a cave? Is he on the run from Absalom? Is he fearing the spear of Saul? We don't know what the situation is, but he can sleep at night because he's trusting his God. That's true courage, isn't it? Courage not in himself, but in his God. And the Lord makes him dwell not in safety so much as in unafraidness because of his trust. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety, yes, despite the circumstances, because I know I'm safe in your hands. The Message, I think, puts this verse, at the day's end, I'm ready for sound sleep, for you, God, have put my life back together. Isn't that great, isn't it? As he's worked through the situation, as he's wrestled with it, he's seen that as he looks up to God, suddenly his life is put back together. Can I ask you this morning, what circumstances are you facing this morning? Are you despairing or deluded or troubled? Are you not sleeping? Is it because you're distressed and afraid? Trust in the Lord. Like David, call out to him. Remember who he is. Look back. See what he's done. Remember who you are. And lie down and sleep. Nicholas Ridley was martyred for his faith. On the night before his execution, his brother came and said, would you like me to stay with you through the night to give you rest, to give you someone to talk to take your mind off the execution tomorrow? And Nicholas Ridley sends him home and quoted this psalm and said, I mean to go to bed and sleep as quietly as ever I did in my life. I'm going to lose my life tomorrow, but I'm trusting in my God. And I'll sleep. I don't need your help. Thank you very much. May we know God's peace and that we might sleep.